Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we have Dr. Tom Grace in the house right now. He's author of Kent State, Death and Descent in the Long 60s. He's a PhD in American history. He spent his life as a social worker as well and a leader of the local, the SEIU, where he was, and when he represented the public employees, and was one of the students shot at Kent State. Some of you may be saying, Kent what? We're about to talk about all of that. So Tom, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Man, some people are going, Kent what? May 4th, 1970, anti-war protest, four killed, nine students shot. You were the ninth student shot.
Yeah, 13 in total.
13 in total, and 10 days later, two were killed and 12 were shot in Jackson State, another protest taking place. But you were at Kent State and you were shot in the ankle. So just
left heel, and took off the right side of my left foot.
Took off the right side of your left foot. Took a lot of reconstructive surgery.
There wasn't that much they could do reconstructive-wise. It's a fused ankle, and I have a hole in my foot that you could put a grapefruit in.
Still?
Yes.
Still?
Yes.
So take us back for those who – we were in the heat of the anti-war movement in America, the Black Power movement, Black Liberation movement, and the anti-war movement against the war in Vietnam. Student protests were happening across the country, and this one took place at Kent State
in Ohio. All of those currents were present on the Kent State University campus.
To talk about, that moment for a minute for our listeners and just set that up for them, if you would.
Well, we'll go back to mid-April of 1970, and many of the leaders of the nationwide protest organizations had despaired that the protest that had been organized the previous fall, what many people remember as the moratorium protest, had failed to gain momentum. And they had so despaired that one of them had actually closed up its operation, the Vietnam Moratorium Committee, the one that had organized the huge protests of the previous fall, October, November of 1969. So on one hand, it shows you how quickly things can change. And President Nixon, who had been elected saying that he had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War, in reality did not. And while the casualties had been very high in Vietnam in 1969, by 1970 he was beginning to withdraw American forces. And that's what caused the leadership of at least some of the national anti-war organizations to think that they were no longer going to be able to mobilize large numbers of people to come out and protest. And then Richard Nixon angered and stunned young Americans throughout the country by announcing on April 30th, 1970, that American and South Vietnamese forces were entering neutral Cambodia, thereby spreading the Vietnam War into a neighboring country. And American campuses exploded in fury, and Kent State was one of them.
Yeah, and I remember that day very well. We had huge demonstrations here as well in this community here on when that invasion took place. But what happened on your campus was the National Guard came in and they opened fire on the students.
Yes. What enabled the National Guard to be mobilized as quickly as they were is there had been a Wildcat Teamster strike in Ohio. It started at the beginning of April and it was gaining momentum on every single week. And the last week of April, then Governor Rhodes, James Rhodes, a Republican in Ohio, mobilized the National Guard to quell the Wildcat Teamster strike. And it was very militant, and a number of the Teamsters had guns and were using them to force drivers off the road who were failing to respect the strike. And the strike was not sanctioned either by the Teamster leadership. So you had a lot at work in that particular strike. But when the downtown area of Kent had a number of merchants had their windows broken by anti-war demonstrators on May 1st. And on May 2nd, when the ROTC building was set afire, it was an old military-style wooden barracks. the National Guard were close by in some of the neighboring communities, and the mayor had asked the governor to mobilize the National Guard, and he did. And within a short period of time that evening, on the evening of May the 2nd, 1,200 National Guardsmen were en route to Kent, and they occupied both the community and the campus.
We all have many people who are from that time, and some who have looked at those photos and studied that time will never forget the picture. I think it was Alison Krauss. Do I have that right? The woman who was laying.
No, it's actually a male student, Jeff Miller.
Jeff Miller.
And there was a young 14-year-old runaway by the name of Marianne Vecchio.
That was it, right,
Who knelt over his body and then looked up in horror, and that's the moment that John Philo snapped the Pulitzer Prize-winning photograph.
And when you were shot, you were put in an ambulance with a woman who eventually died.
Sandy Scheuer, she was, I think she was dead by the time. I remember the sheet being pulled up over her head when I was in the ambulance with her. She had been shot through the neck and jugular vein. She had really
a student.
Yeah, she had
a college
out.
Student at
yeah.
Kansas.
Yes. She was a speech major too. So,
and I mean
speech and pathology major.
Not to dwell on this, I want to get into some of the issues today and with Jackson State and why you wrote this book and what you're trying to say to us. But we can only imagine what it must have been like for you sitting and lying in that ambulance, wounded yourself, shot, and this young woman was shot and killed in her body next to you.
Right. I had met her, been introduced to her about 10 days beforehand, and I didn't even recognize her at first, but then I...
That must have been very difficult. It must be difficult even now to think about.
I'm able to compartmentalize pretty well. I had to in order to be able to write this book and to have the right kind of scholarly detachment from the subject.
So, and let's talk about the significance of this moment, these moments. And I said these moments because I think what happened at Kent State really has to be remembered and talked about. So does what happened at Jackson State. And we often leave that out, what happened at Jackson State, out of the conversation, which is not untypical for America with our racist past to do that. Not press, but present as well.
Right.
So talk about this. I mean, what Kent State, what those moments mean for where we live now in this 2017, and why you feel compelled to do this that way.
Well, first of all, the book is a traditional history. It takes the story of the student movement. It's really a book about the student movement at Kent State from 1958 to 1973, January of 1973. And it tells the story of the cascading movements, the first political activity on the campus after the chill of the McCarthy years was a student effort to help defeat an anti-labor measure that the Republican Party and the business community in Ohio wanted to insert into the Ohio Constitution to make it a right-to-work state. And fortunately, that was defeated. There was a lot of segregation. It was a de facto segregation in Kent, Ohio. Kent was not alone in that. It was rather typical. But the students successfully protested that for two or three years. And many of the veterans of those struggles were the ones who did the initial anti-war organizing in the campus as early as 1964 when Kent had a picket against the buildup of the American occupation in South Vietnam, and then particularly after the bombing started in February of 1965. And it takes the story through the remainder of the decade, the fatal shootings, and then the important aftermath where the fatal shootings failed to silence the dissent on the campus. And unfortunately, many historians have bought into the conservative myth that that violent repression will silence dissent. Sometimes it does, but it didn't. But that did not happen at Kent State. Some of the largest protests occurred as many as 2 years after the fatal shootings in May of 1970, and the two largest mass arrests that ever occurred on the campus occurred in 1972 and as late as 1977.
So in writing this book, and especially that you're going around speaking about this book now, on the heels of the final 8 years of the first black president to Donald Trump now in the White House. I mean, What do you think for people the significance of this is? What is the connection for you between what happened there, what happened at Jackson State, and where we are now? What do we learn from this?
Things can happen and change very quickly. We went from mid-April, touch again on a point I made earlier, mm-hmm. We went from mid-April of 1970 with the leadership of some of the most important anti-war organizations in the country feeling that there was no hope of revitalizing the anti-Vietnam protest movement to the largest mass student strike in American history that involved 4 million people.
Right.
That really terrified the Nixon administration, even according to some of the people who served in it. And there were a number of reforms that that took place. At that time, you had to be 21 in order to vote. That same month, there was legislation introduced in the United States Congress to lower the voting age to 18. And by 1971, three-fourths of the states had ratified that amendment. It's very difficult to pass a constitutional amendment in the United States, but that one took a little over a year.
Right, I remember that, yeah.
There were measures passed, not as strong as they should have been, but there were measures passed, the War Powers Act, that put some curbs on presidential power to act unilaterally. Our own court case, we had a civil action, and initially the state of Ohio was protected under the 11th Amendment from any suits. And our case went to the United States Supreme Court, and we won that case 8-0, with one justice abstaining. That gave us that determined that the state of Ohio only had limited immunity, not total immunity, and that enabled us to go forward with a civil rights case or a civil damages case against the state of Ohio. It's too long of a story to go into, but that lasted for the remainder of the decade and was not resolved until January of 1979. But one thing I would try to impart to your listeners is that how quickly things can change in the United States, and you never know how powerful your actions can be. Certainly, when we began our protest at Kent State on May 1st, 1970, we had no idea what was in store for us 4 days later. But the National Guard made my classmates and my university into a symbol, and it wound up forcing Richard Nixon to have to withdraw American forces from Cambodia much sooner than he ever intended to, and he was very dissatisfied as well with the efforts of the investigatory agencies, particularly the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to find what he felt were foreign sources subsidizing the protest movement in the United States.
Right.
And he was so dissatisfied that he created his own network that led to the plumbers. Those plumbers, of course, broke into the Democratic National offices at the Watergate Hotel. And that brought about Richard Nixon's downfall. And even his own one of his chief aides, H.R. Haldeman, said in the Ends of Power that Kent State marked the beginning of the long downhill slide for Nixon to Watergate.
It's true. That's important to make that connection. I'm glad you're doing that, and you did that. And you've been back to Kent State many, many times. It's important.
Both for the commemorations, and that's where I did the majority of my research.
Right. You told a story before we started this conversation I think it's important to tell. When you and your wife were driving through Jackson, Mississippi, which is where Jackson State is, where the black students were killed 10 days later on campus and many injured confronting the police. And you met this young woman, and you made this connection. So tell, I think that's a really important piece of this.
Yes. Very, very quickly, the first time I met students from Jackson State was at Senator Ted Kennedy's McLean, Virginia estate in 1970, because he had a fundraiser for the students who had been wounded at Kent and Jackson State. Many of us did not have insurance.
That fundraiser
alone raised $65,000. And in subsequent years, when there's been an annual commemoration of the four people who lost their lives at Kent State, every year since May of 1971, it continues to this day. And we often have speakers from Jackson State at these commemorations. And we've had some very large demonstrations there in the late 70s in particular, when the university tried to successfully construct a gymnasium on a part of the area where the National Guard maneuvered in 1970. But the slogan that the students popularized in that year was "Long Live the Spirit of Kent and Jackson State." And a few years ago, when my wife and I were traveling south, I promised to take her to New Orleans. My side of the bargain was that I would be able to stop at a number of Civil War battlefields in Jackson, Mississippi, en route. And our point in stopping in Jackson, of course, was to see the site of the fatal shootings. And we'd seen it during the day, and we stayed overnight in Jackson. And that evening, we were having dinner in a restaurant, and we encountered a young woman who was a waitress there. And I asked her if she went to Jackson State, and she replied in the affirmative. And I asked her if she had knowledge about what had taken place at her university in 1970. And to my pleasant surprise, she told me that she was one of the students that helped put on the annual commemoration there. So that led to a very interesting discussion. She did not know the full story of my own background, but I was subsequently able to make arrangements with the student organization at Kent State that puts on the annual commemoration to invite her. And I think this was in January or February, and a few months later she was up in Kent, Ohio, speaking at the commemoration.
And that's significant in so many ways. One of the things you said as we were talking earlier, and I think it's an important point to put out, is that after the students were shot and killed at Kent State and then shot and killed at Jackson State, the group that organized to raise money for the students who were killed and shot and for everything else was Kent Jackson. It wasn't just Kent State. That's really – people forget that. We think it was completely separate, but you all connected in a very powerful way.
Right. Well, at Kent State at least as I'm able to tell it in my book, there was a lot of unity between black and white students over the years. Now, sometimes that unity became strained, particularly in the late 1960s when there was more of a national strain in the black liberation struggle. But even then, when the Oakland police force came to Kent State in November of 1968.
That's the county force.
No, Oakland, California.
Okay.
They came to Kent State. They were invited by the
law. Oh, I see what you're saying.
The law enforcement school at Kent State to come and recruit there. And that same police force had been waging a series of raids on Black Panther Party headquarters in Oakland. Many of your listeners will remember that that's where the Black Panther Party originated. And that same year, they had fatally shot a young 17-year-old member of the party by the name of Bobby Hutton and wounded Eldridge Cleaver in the same shootout. So it was just a number of months later that same Oakland police force came to Kent State. And the Students for Democratic Society and the Black United students at Kent State determined that they were not going to recruit any students at Kent State, and they took over the area where these recruitment hearings or meetings were to take place, and they completely blocked off access. And when the university threatened to charge the students who had participated in the sit-in, the Black United students demanded amnesty for everyone who had participated. The university failed to grant it, so the Black students on the campus, almost to a person, and there were 500 or 600 on the campus then, walked off the campus and vowed that they would not return until amnesty was granted for all of the students. And the university capitulated in about 2 or 3 days. And it was a very, very powerful lesson for the students there that what unity could bring about.
Well, this has been a joy to meet you. I look forward to one day maybe having a much longer conversation. This has been great.
Well, thank you, Mark. I do as well.
And I like the book a lot. So we've been talking to Dr. Tom Grace. The book is Kent State, Death and Dissent in the Long 60s. A history of the movement in Kent State that led to the death of students in Kent State, 4 killed, 9 wounded, if I have that, am I right?
Yes.
And just 10 days later, 2 killed and 12 wounded on Jackson State. He's a PhD in history, social worker, union organizer, union leader, and one of the students who was shot at Kent State. And Tom, thanks so much for coming to Baltimore. Thanks so much for being here.
You're quite welcome, Mark. Thank you for the opportunity.
We have to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we're going to reach back into our archives and hear an incredible conversation I did with the late, great world heavyweight champion of the world, Joe Frazier. Before we go to break, I want to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association. From limited over-testing to protecting public school funding, you can learn more about the issues facing Maryland students, parents, and schools by visiting the Maryland State Education Association website at MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. Or SteinerShow.org is Maryland State Education Association banner.